So I'm going to tell you about LHCb, which is actually in real life pictured in the background here. That's the real detector. You can see roughly the scale with these sets of steps and things.
Where's the beam here?
Sorry, I'm trying to. One beam will be coming in about right here, and the other one here, and the collision happens sort of right along the wall, basically. So this is the Large Hadron Collider. I'm sort of assuming people are somehow interested in particle physics and know this stuff. I gave a seminar at Los Alamos last week, and I got originally stopped, and they said, "Like, well, where is this experiment? And who are these people?" So, okay, fine. Right. So LHCb is actually at point 8, which is right by the Geneva Airport. Interesting fact, in the original design from like 20 years ago, there was a plan to have a hologram on the roof, so when you flew into Geneva, you would see this. And unsurprisingly, when the budgets got tight, that was one of the first things to go. So the outline of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about LHCb itself, just so you're familiar with what it is and can do. And then the core physics program is flavor physics. LHCb is now since 2011 has become the premier flavor physics factory in the world as Babar has shut down, Bell has shut down, and Bell 2 has not yet turned on. I'll then talk a little bit about some other directions, like looking for low mass beyond the standard model particles, and then a little bit about standard model physics, which we're also doing. So this is the schematic of the detector. So you would picture this. Pointer's not, okay. You can picture one beam coming in this way. I don't know if you can see that. One beam coming this way and the other beam coming here through this beam pipe. The collision happens here. Stuff goes, in fact, in all directions, but we instrument the forward region from 2 to 5 in rapidity. Most of the detector is sort of standard things like hadronic calorimeters and muon systems, and so similar to previous experiments. The real sort of revolutionary differences of this experiment with respect to others, apart from instrumenting the forward region, one is what we call the vertex locator or VALO. This is a silicon detector that actually, at the moment, instruments 8 millimeters from the beam line. So of course, the closer you get, the better resolution you have. This gives us a resolution on proper lifetime for Beauty and Charm hadrons of about 45 femtoseconds. So this is ridiculous compared to previous experiments. So we can see B sub S oscillations and all these things very easily. We also have 2 ring imaging Cherenkov detectors, one here and one here, and this gives us the ability to do hadronic particle identification over a large range of momenta. So for example, this is a plot showing the efficiency to identify a kaon as a function of momentum from basically 0 up to 100 GeV versus if you mis-ID, the probability of mis-IDing a pion as a kaon. And so you're going to see you have this amazing ability to separate pions, kaons, protons from a few GeV up to hundreds of GeV. So this is a totally unique ability as well. But perhaps the most interesting, well, to me, I work on the trigger, so I'll give away my bias. Here is the trigger system in LHCb. So what we're doing in run 2, the crossing rate at the LHC is 40 megahertz. And in the current detector with the front end electronics, we can only read this out at about at 1 megahertz. I say only, this is still a very high rate to be reading out at. And so we have to get from the 40 megahertz down to 1 megahertz in hardware. And so we do this in the standard way by looking for like hadrons with high transverse energy, muons with high transverse momentum. But for us, because we're only going to 1 megahertz, high transverse momentum for muons is about a GeV if it's dimuon, and it's a few GeV if it's 1 muon. And for hadrons, it's only about 4 GeV, it's the transverse energy threshold. I mean, so effectively, these are very soft thresholds compared to the other experiments. We then go into our software trigger at the 1 megahertz. And what we do is we run our full tracking reconstruction, but only for tracks with PT above half a GeV. Okay, so that's pretty soft. Basically, the higher you set this threshold, the less CPU time it takes to do tracking. So this is basically just a function of how many CPUs you have. We have 50,000 cores that run in the online system. It's about 5 million Swiss francs worth of computers that actually run this. There's no IP requirements or anything else. So this is just a full tracking, but just for a momentum threshold. We then make selection requirements at this stage based on this tracking. So we might have displaced vertices, displaced tracks, muons, various other things that happen. And we go to 150 kilohertz, which is still a very high rate. So this is a rather loose selection that you're making. Now at this point, and this is a revolution that we actually did in run 2, we have 5 petabytes of disk in the online system. And we actually buffer this 150 kilohertz on disk, and we run the final calibration and alignment. So at this point, we have the full, pristine, perfect data. And this is quite important for us. For example, with ring imaging Cherenkov detectors, they have gas in them, and gas pressure changes hourly. They have to be constantly calibrated. So if you want to use that in your trigger, you really want to have the final calibrated version, not just some average running over, say, months or whatever. And so that's what we do. And so this is really the first real-time calibration of a detector. We then run our full reconstruction in the online system on the remaining 150 kilohertz of events to select what we're going to keep. At this stage, this is the final reconstruction with everything done. And so, in fact, some of the analyses now are actually just being done on this stuff. There's no offline reconstruction. You just analyze that. There's no reason to do anything further. In fact, I mean, we have things like neural network, fake track killing algorithms, all the fancy stuff. They all run here in the online system. So this is the full data. I'll just mention that also we were quite bold, even already in run one. Our main trigger was a boosted decision tree. So this was machine learning using our main trigger that was used in about 60% of our papers, which is about 200 papers. We have about 300 total papers. This was done in the machine learning algorithm that is actually a custom algorithm that I invented. It's here. In run two, we're actually doing almost all machine learning everywhere because it works better. And I'll mention and discuss later that while this is state of the art and extremely impressive, in run three, we want to get rid of this first bit. We want to just go straight into the software at 40 megahertz because why wouldn't you? And we think we can do it. So, yeah.
Silly question. So during run one, Alpha got some 20 inverts femtomers, but you got
three.
Why is that?
So basically, the detector itself doesn't really perform with the full pileup. There's a few things. One, ring imaging systems are not super good if you have, say, 20 proton-proton collisions. So in each of these so every time you have a particle above your Cherenkov threshold, you get a ring. Okay, so you have a few overlapping rings, it's not a problem. If you've got 1,000 overlapping rings, the pattern recognition starts to become pretty much impossible. So that's one thing that's very tough. The other thing is that we actually, because our first tracking station is 8 millimeters from the beam, the amount of radiation you'll get in there and heat, you have to cool this thing. If you're running at a pileup of 20, the current system would just fry, basically. In run three, we're upgrading this detector to actually be 5 millimeters from the collision point, but also to be able to be cooled better. And so the luminosity is going to go up by a factor of 5. So the pileup will be about 8 or something like that. So we'll be closer to them in run 3. But effectively, those are the limitations. Okay, so here's a graphic I made to maybe put this in a perspective that you might be more familiar with. So this is here in this box. This is CMS where I've removed, well, it's actually whited out, but it's hard to see on this projector. I basically removed half the detector for making it easier. And I've overlaid LHCb to scale as good as I can in Keynote. And so you can see really that effectively this region where CMS is missing tracking is where we essentially sit. The other thing you can see is that our tracking systems, which are these gray points, the color schemes are the same. So we track from, say, here out to here for charged particles is a much larger region than CMS. And so we actually have better momentum resolution and dihadron mass resolution and dimuon mass and things like that. But effectively, in terms of coverage in kinematics, these are complementary because we cover the forward region. All right, so I first want to talk about flavor physics, which is based on this historically very good way of discovering new physics, which is the fact that you can indirectly observe the effects of heavy particles as their virtual contributions to lower energy systems, right? So basically, beta decay is the sort of the first amazing example where the beta decay of the neutron was observed 5 decades before the W boson was made in the lab. Right, and so this is this great, of course, if you zoom in and you go to high energy, you can see that you have this quark radiating a W boson. But if you're sitting at low energy, you can just treat this as a 4-Fermi interaction, as Fermi, in fact, did. And you can definitely observe the presence of the weak force in this decay. So generically, then, what you can imagine doing is you look at all the data you can, in our case, where quark flavor changing currents are involved. And you just try to measure all of the observables, and then you try to write down an effective Hamiltonian at this energy scale for whatever the physics of nature is. And so this is the standard operator product expansion, right? So you have all these operators, which represent Lorentz structure. So maybe you have left-handed quark current and a vector lepton current, or maybe you have a right-handed quark current and a scalar lepton current or whatever. And these will have some what's known Wilson coefficients that sit in front of them, which have some standard model component, which may or may not be zero. And then hopefully there's, at least in some of them, some beyond the standard model component. And I just mentioned that when you're doing this type of approach, when you're looking at low energy systems, the amplitudes you're probing always are proportional to whatever the coupling constant is divided by whatever the mass scale squared is. And you can't separate these. You're always observing the ratio of these things. Okay, so this is always what you're actually sensitive to. In principle, you can probe any mass scale, because even if you go up to, you know, make this m go to infinity, there's still a non-zero amplitude there. In practice, you're limited by your precision experimentally and theoretically. So if you can't predict what the standard model says for something, you obviously don't know if you've seen a new effect or not. And so you need to look at things that are both sort of easy to predict and measure. So one of the classic, sort of the golden mode, is what's called the either B sub D or B sub S. So just to remind you what these are, if you're not familiar with staring at meson names all the time, a B sub S is where you have, say, an anti-B quark and an S quark. And a B sub D is just you replace the S quark with a D quark. So it's a neutral meson that has a B in it, and then the light quark is either a D or an S. So it's like, as far as meson name goes, this is actually pretty good. All right, most of them are much less clear. So if you want to look at this going from a system with a B quark and an S quark into two muons, in the standard model, there's no tree level amplitude for this. So there's no coupling of the Z to the B and the S, right? So instead, in the standard model, you have to rely on these rather ugly box diagrams or penguin annihilation diagrams or whatever. And not surprisingly, that if you have to do these type of things, the rate is very small. So the standard model prediction for a B sub S particle to go into two muons is the branching fraction is roughly about 3.4 times 10 to the minus 9. Okay, so that's pretty small. For the B sub D, if you just look at these diagrams and you replace this S quark with a D quark, you can see that that's going to be even further CKM suppressed. And so it's 20 times smaller, the branching fraction for the B sub D. So then I could imagine, though, that there might be some beyond the standard model amplitude here. And because these amplitudes are so small, then the relative impact of yet another small amplitude could be big. Right? So this could be a rather big impact, and you could have a big effect. So for example, this was a plot made by David Straub before LHC running began. And what it shows here is on the x-axis is the branching fraction of the Bs to mu mu times a billion. And on the y-axis, it shows the Bd to mu mu times a billion. And the standard model sits down here with very small uncertainty. And then what he's doing is just taking a bunch of models that existed at the time, various supersymmetry models or fourth generation standard model thing, you know, and just seeing, well, where do the unexcluded parameter spaces of these models sit in this plane? And effectively, they sit everywhere. Okay, so you had lots of SUSY models that wanted to enhance this branching fraction by a factor of 10, and maybe not enhance this one, so you'd be sitting here, but maybe enhances them both by a factor of 10, and you're sitting way up here or whatever. In principle, you could be anywhere in this plane, and the only experimental limits on this plane were contained in this region, and to the right was excluded by the Tevatron. Okay, so that's basically where you were. After 30 years of experimentalists looking for this decay, both LHCb and CMS had greater than 4 sigma significance for the B sub S decay in RON 1. And we combined our data, so there's a combined, actually putting the data themselves together and a combined analysis. This is published in Nature. It's, I think, quite likely the largest author list of any paper ever. I'm not 100% sure that that's true, but I'm not sure who else would have a combined, you know, it must be about 4,000 people or something combined, I don't know. The analysis is quite complicated. It uses a bunch of machine learning algorithms, but the easiest plot to look at is this is in the region that the machine learning thinks is the cleanest. And you can see this is the dimuon mass. The data are in black. You expect a sort of a combinatorial background that sits around here. There's some partially reconstructed semileptonic decays that are at lower mass. And then effectively, you have this excess in the region where the B sub S and the B sub D sit. And you can clearly see that there's this excess here, but it's also seen in the less pure regions and everything. In total, the B sub S decay is seen at 6 sigma, and the BD is about 3. So it's, you know, it's questionable whether we actually see the B sub D decay or not. but the B sub SDK is there. I made this plot just to show what we actually measure for these branching fractions compared to the standard model, since that's what you really care about. So the standard model then is 1 by definition. The width of this red line is the standard model uncertainty. So it's well known compared to what we can currently probe. The yellow here is what we measure for B sub S. It's a little bit hard to see on this projector, but it's basically 1 sigma. Okay, so that's agreement. The B sub D has a much larger error bar. It's a little bit less than 2 sigma, so this is consistent. The only thing that's maybe remotely even on the edge of not consistent, but it's still consistent, is if you take the ratio of the branching fraction of the B sub D to the B sub S, this actually is the most precise thing you can calculate in the standard model, because a lot of the QCD uncertainty cancels here. And the ratio is basically 1 over 20 or something like that. This is actually showing a likelihood profile with 1 sigma and 2 sigma, so we're slightly more than 2 sigma away, but that's, I would still say, consistent. So there's minor tension, but you need more data. But overall, I think you would say that this is, while seen before LHC running as like a golden mode to look for new physics, it so far looks to be consistent. So if you go back to this David Straub plot and I overlay some gray bits, I mean, effectively, we've just ruled out all of this parameter space, and the only thing that survives is right in this region around where the standard model sits. But ruling out SUSY parameter space is a pretty easy game, actually. And it's not particularly, you can spend the rest of your life doing this. So then people always want to know, well, what mass scale are you actually probing? And of course, the answer is it really depends on what the model is. So for example, if the new physics model has tree level flavor violation, so if I could draw this diagram, so if there's some new particle, the new boson X, and it happens to couple to B and S and dimuons, then I have a tree level diagram, right? So this is then going to, in principle, give me a rather large rate unless I pump up the mass of the X. So basically, we're sort of setting limits on the few TeV to 10 TeV sort of range for this type of physics. But if my new physics doesn't have this type of coupling, I might need to go into this situation where I couple my new particle X plus to only, say, top and bottom, so there's no flavor changing coupling there. Or I might have to go even more extreme. I might say that this new particle X doesn't couple to the quarks at all, so I have to actually do a W loop and then couple it to the W. And so if I do these things, of course, I have loop suppression, I have other things, and so I'm probing not quite as high a mass scale, but we're still getting into the sort of close to a TeV type of range here, unless you arbitrarily then just start reducing these couplings. You say, okay, well, the coupling's not of order 1, it's just 10 to the minus 5 for some reason. So effectively, this is what you want to do then, is just measure everything, hopefully find discrepancies, and solve the puzzle, because different models will affect different observables in different ways. And this is what you do with these global analyses. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so another one of these golden modes that there's lots and lots of theory on and was talked about a lot before we started running is what's known as the B sub S penguin decays. So this is where I have my B quark, and then if I torture the diagram a bit, I can make it look like a penguin. And if I add this nice, so the thing too, right, is I can't have a, it took me like 5 minutes to make this, by the way, it's totally, totally stupid. I can't have a free B quark, right, so I have to put either another quark or possibly two quarks and make this either a meson or a baryon. And so while this part of the diagram is pretty easy to calculate, I have to also appreciate that there are QCD effects that get me from whatever this hadron is to whatever this hadron is. And QCD, you may be aware of, is actually hard, right? It's actually quite hard. And so you need to get some form factors from either the lattice or light cone sum rules or wherever. It depends on what sort of recoil you're talking about. But the good thing is that, whatever, I put different hadrons here, they have different quantum numbers, and these give me all kinds of access to different observables. So if I have a vector meson here, it can decay into two scalars. Now I have a four-body final state. There's all kinds of angular distributions I can measure. And those are actually quite sensitive to the Lorentz structure of whatever the actual amplitude is, right? And we can predict this from the standard model and then compare. Now, I'm going to show you a few observables. And the ones on the top, I don't want to go into what the details are, but in every plot, the x-axis is what's called Q squared. That's the dimuon mass squared, okay? So this is the momentum recoil, basically. So this is generally what we always plot against. In every plot, you may also notice that there's no data here, and there's no data here. There's also no theory predictions, and that's because this is the J psi, and that's the psi 2s. Okay, so that's just a totally, termonium resonances are enormous. It's totally different physics, and so we just cut that out. Okay, so then this top left plot, this is basically an Angular observable. It doesn't really matter what it is. The black is the data. The magenta boxes are the standard model prediction put in the same bins as the data. And the height of the boxes represent the standard model uncertainty. And so you can see that, in fact, the data and the theory agree here. This is actually a B to D penguin decay. This is further suppressed. This is a branching fraction as a function of the dimuon mass. And you can see the units here in these bins are 10 to the minus 9. So this is an extremely small rate. And what you're seeing is, okay, there's different theories here, and there's not great statistical precision. So this will improve a lot in run two, but again, this agrees. And largely, what you end up with is lots and lots of angular distributions that agree with the standard model, where the error bars are roughly translating into 10 TeV as the mass scale of, you know, what you would expect new physics to shift things by. So that's the mass scale you're probing. Largely, things agree. There's a few things that don't agree. One here, this is a where I just have my spectator quark as an S quark, so I get a phi meson. This is the branching fraction. And what you can see is in the low Q squared, which is low dimuon mass, you can see that the standard model prediction is actually quite a bit higher than the data. Now you might say, okay, maybe with these error bars, that's a little bit less than 3 sigma. But it turns out it doesn't matter what meson I put here and what meson or I put here. They're all low by about the same factor of 2 or something like this. There's this sort of consistent picture that all the channels find that in this region of mass, the branching fraction is lower than the prediction. Okay, so it's very much unlikely that it's a statistical fluctuation. But of course, the theory predictions are all completely correlated. So it could easily be like one problem in the form factor that just changes all of them by the same amount. But it's unlikely that it's a fluctuation. We also seem to see tension. This is a different angular observable where you can see the standard model prediction now is in yellow. We don't have like a consistent color theme for the standard model. And again, there's this tension in this same mass region, this sort of where the dimuons are in this region. And essentially, in this one observable, just in these two bins, it's actually almost 4 sigma. And globally, in things, it's more like 4 sigma. So something's going on, and the question is, is it QCD doing something unexpected? You know, we really just don't know what we're doing. Or is it new physics? Now, luckily, there are observables that are not actually sensitive to the QCD part. So for example, if I take my B to S penguin decay, and if I look at, for example, where I spit off either the Z or the gamma, and that goes to either mu plus mu minus or E plus E minus, then, of course, the standard model, as long as I take the dileptone mass to be big enough that the muon mass doesn't matter, the standard model doesn't care whether I have an electron or a muon here. And so, if I actually make the dileptone mass more than a GeV, it turns out the standard model prediction is at the per mil level, just that this ratio is 1. Okay? And, of course, QCD doesn't care, so it's not going to change this. So we know this is one of these nice observables that we can go after where QCD is not going to do anything. And in fact, we measured this in run one, and we get something that's about 2.6 sigma away from one. So what we're finding is that this is about 0.75. And what's good is that the precision is dominated by statistics, which means take more data, and you know, if this is real, you'll know, right? You don't have to actually work hard. But we are working hard, and actually this is coming down too. The systematics is gonna, uncertainty is going to go down, and we're going to measure this in more modes, and we'll see that soon. But it's interesting that it's seen in the same region where the other things are disagreeing. We also see that this very clean ratio is, you know, not 3 sigma, but it's interesting that it's not completely in agreement. There's also another place where you can do these same kind of ideas. You can look at decays where you have, say, a decay where you have a B that becomes charm, and in the standard model you're emitting a W, but you could of course be emitting a charged Higgs or some other new particle. And then you end up with either, say, a tau or muon or electron. So you can take the ratio where you have the tau versus where you have a muon or an electron. Now, in this case, the ratio from the standard model is not 1 because the tau mass is big enough that the phase space doesn't, you can't just, there's no region you go to that you can somehow cancel this out completely. But this calculation, nonetheless, is pretty well under control. And so on this plot, what you're seeing is the case, you have the ratio where you have a tau as the lepton versus a muon. And in the x-axis, you could have the charm meson is the pseudoscalar ground state charm meson. But you could also on the y-axis have that the charm meson is an excited charm meson. So it's a vector charm meson. And the standard model prediction is that essentially these are both around 0.3. and the uncertainty is sort of shown by the size of this magenta ring. These ratios have been measured actually by Babar, Bell, and LHCb, which are shown as the black is Babar, the blue is Bell. LHCb has so far only measured the y-axis, so we get a box. We're working on the x-axis. And the three experiments are very nicely consistent, and you can average them and get this red ring, which completely overlaps all of them, but is actually quite far. It's almost four sigma away from where the standard model is. So again, I think this four sigma, you know, it's probably not a fluctuation, but this is a very hard measurement.
So the L in on the bottom of the picture, that can be either a muon or an electron. Does the blood look the same when you do tau over electron and then separate the tau over muon?
Yeah, so we only measured the muon, because for us the muon's the cleanest. We only used the muon. But Babar looked at both, and they're consistent. So they don't see a difference between the muon and the electron.
Okay, but they also see overall consensus. That's what they see.
Yeah, so they combine them to get better statistical precision to do the measurement.
And the ratio between the muon and electron is about...
That's what I'm saying, yeah, those are consistent. They appear to be consistent when you have a muon and an electron. So, I mean, these are sort of different things. This is probably not a fluctuation, but it's a hard measurement. This is a pretty easy measurement, but it could be a fluctuation. And on the previous one, it's an easy measurement, but it's a hard calculation. Okay, so you know it's an interesting situation where those are the things you have. And I'll talk about sort of how to put them together in a second. But then I just wanted to say that, I mean, you know, okay, that was cherry picking a few out of a few hundred papers that happen to see discrepancies. You can also do these things, you know, like neutral meson oscillations are one of the more interesting pieces of phenomenology I think there is. Where in the standard model, you can have an anti-B quark and an S quark, and you can go through a box diagram and become an anti-S quark and a B quark. So you can go from a B meson to an anti-B meson. And so we actually can look at this in experiment. I just love this plot. So this is, you can imagine you make a particle and then it decays, or you can make the particle and it turns into its antiparticle and then it decays. And so this is shown in this picture here as a function of proper time, and the units here are in picoseconds. And we can see the case where it goes through this path versus this path, and you can see in the data that these actually just oscillate like this. I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful. And we can see this so cleanly because our resolution, as I said, is about 45 femtoseconds on this axis, so this is good. The bad thing is that all of the oscillation rates and lack of CP violation seen in oscillations, everything is consistent with the standard model in oscillations. And I mean, you can go and look at what sort of mass scales you're probing if you assume that the coupling constants are one in neutral meson oscillations. And of course, kaon physics is really depressing, right? I mean, this is for a long time been probing just ridiculous mass scales, right? 10 to the 5 TeV in some cases. And charm is like 10 to the 4 TeV. And in the B systems, it's about 1,000 TeV. So these put really serious constraints on what kind of models you can build and not be in conflict with the data. So if you put it all together, and there's several groups that do global fits. They put down the effective Hamiltonian. They take in all the observables, and they run these fits to get at the Wilson coefficients, which is the model-independent way of actually doing this, right? So each one of those coefficients sits in front of an operator, and it's basically then you're putting limits on the existence of, say, a left-handed quark current and a scalar vector, you know, scalar lepton current, et cetera, all the different currents that exist. And so if you summarize that, and this is a nice review paper that I can point you to if you're interested. Roughly speaking, left-handed, so beyond the standard model physics, if you have a left-handed quark current and either a vector or axovector lepton current, these Wilson coefficients are basically less than or equal to the standard model Wilson coefficients. And this is a non-trivial statement, though, because the standard model, everything is CKM suppressed and at the electroweak scale. So this is not like this is a non-trivial statement about what's going on. The constraints on right-handed quark currents are basically the same as left-handed. But the constraints on scalar and tensor operators are actually just really, really strong, okay? Because these contribute to like the B sub S to mu and the oscillations and things. So these are really, really constrained. And overall, the data is, I would say, you know, consistent with the standard model, with the exception, and so the limits basically, if you're doing tree level, some people claim about 50 TeV is the limits of tree level if the coupling constants are one. Whereas if you have to go to loops that don't couple to quarks, you're at about half a TeV at the moment. So if you just change your models so that things don't couple to quarks, then you can, of course, push this down. But overall, this is, you know, pretty stringent, and only a fraction of this space is actually accessible to the LHC in direct production. However, as I said, there's this sort of four sigma discrepancy in the global fits, and it's driven by the things I showed, the branching fractions in BS to mu mu, et cetera, where things just don't agree, and those drive that. And so if you want to just be an optimist and just say, well, all discrepancies are from beyond the standard model of physics, and let's say nothing we're seeing is a fluctuation or a QCD, which is probably not so likely, but you know, if you do that, then you would say, okay, well, new physics couples to leptonic vector and or axial vector currents. We need that for some of these angular distributions that we see discrepancies in. You would say, well, there's non-universal lepton couplings because there's those two anomalies that show that. And it may, because it's interesting anyway that the constraints on right-handed quark currents are no better than left. So you might say that you're seeing some right-handed quark current. And so, of course, there's like, you know, lots and lots of papers on the archive that attempt to explain all of the anomalies at once, and typically they all break down into something that's either like a Z prime, so you could do something like this, or leptoquark. Leptoquarks are very nice ways to get non-universal lepton couplings, right? And anyway, what you obviously find is that roughly the anomalies we see are consistent with some new particle with a mass that's of order, say, a few TeV. Okay. But whether there is or not, and it's all just, you know, not there is up in the air. So that's basically the state of the art for flavor physics. And luckily, run 2 is underway, and we're going to actually have more flavor data in 2016 than we had in all of run 1. So if any of these statistical things that could be statistical fluctuations are real, we'll know basically in about a year from now. Okay, so I wanted to move then into doing direct searches. And for us, at the moment, we're focusing more on things like low mass, where CMS and Atlas are not so good. Okay. And so, for example, I can take my same B to S penguin decay, and instead of putting a Z boson or a gamma here, I could put some new particle, say chi. And this is good because, see, this has got a top quark in the loop. So if you imagine you have some new physics that mixes with the Higgs sector in some way, so you could have axion portals or inflatons or whatever you want, then this new particle may pick up a sizable Yukawa coupling to the top quark and, in fact, be produced copiously in this sort of transition. It's an interesting way to go look for it because if you need this thing to couple to top quarks, you don't really want to look for it when you're producing real top quarks because those are really violent, interesting events. And if this thing has a mass of about 400 MeV or something, it's going to be pretty hard to see this soft dilepton there. But in this case, it's a very clean environment, and I'll show that. I'm not going to go into the details. It's quite interesting, actually, trying to search for low-mass physics because you have to deal with the fact that, in fact, there's lots of QCD resonances that are bumps that you can't predict, and they interfere with each other, and so produce some sort of background spectrum that you can't actually predict a priori. And so you have to handle that, and I actually wrote a paper on this, how to do it in an easy way. You also don't know the mass or the lifetime of this guy, so if you want to go train a machine learning algorithm and have some selection, you have to then make it optimal for all possible masses and lifetimes. And I have also then wrote a paper on this, which used in the analysis. So we go look for this, and as you can guess, we didn't find a new particle, right? I always make the analogy of like, I don't know if you, when I was a kid, they had all these shows on all the time about trying to find Bigfoot or the Yeti or whatever. And they like try to keep it in suspense, like you don't know whether they found them or not. And you think, if they found them, surely I would know, like from not this program, right? That's looking at footage from 20 years ago. So yes, we don't find it. This is actually what we observed for the dimuon spectrum in bins of 10 MeV. So the grayed out region are known resonances where we had to veto them. So for example, you can have a phi, so you can make B goes to K star phi, and then the phi goes to mu mu. And the phi width is only 4 MeV, which is roughly the mass resolution there. So you can't blindly go look for that because you're expecting a bump. And in fact, we do see the bump. The omega is the same, and the J psi is just enormous, I mean, because it's a different Feynman diagram. So it goes off the scale. What's shown is the black is what we call prompt. So what that means is that the dimuon vertex is less than 3 sigma from the K pi vertex. That's what we decided to do here. And displaced just simply means that it's greater than 3 sigma. And so, in fact, you expect to see some J size here because 3 sigma probability is much bigger than actually than the number of J size we have. So you actually expected like 1,000 J size to be displaced just by that particular level of significance.
What is that in distance?
That's a good question. I have to maybe think about this for a second. I mean, it's probably something like a millimeter or something like that. But I have to think about the kinematics again. I actually did this analysis myself, so I should know, but I don't remember. So you know, you see a bunch of bumps, but none of them are actually significant. The most significant, this is good, maybe a good like test. Where is the most significant excess in the spectrum? It turns out actually that it's here, because this one displaced candidate, the only displaced candidate below about 800 MeV, it sits exactly where there's an excess of like 5 prompt candidates over the back. So it's like in this one little region here, there's like 11 candidates as opposed to the expectation of 5. Anyway, it's not significant. So we place model-independent limits. In gray here is shown the absolute branching fraction of B goes to K star times this with this new boson times the branching fraction that this new boson then of course goes to mu mu. We can't separate that. And roughly speaking, this is a function of the mass and lifetime. At lifetimes below about 100 picoseconds, we're setting limits that are about 10 to the minus 9. And then as it gets bigger than that, it actually starts flying out of the detector with the boosts that we have. So we have these model independent limits, but you can of course convert these into limits on a model. And so, for example, here's one of Jesse's models where you have an axion portal. So here the limits are set as a function of the axion decay constant times tan squared beta. And it turns out in this model it depends on actually the charged Higgs mass. So on this axis is if the charged Higgs is at a TeV, and here we did it for 10 TeV just to show 2. You can, of course, take the data and do it however you want. You also don't know, of course, this new particle branching fraction to hadrons. So we did it for no branching fraction to hadrons versus basically dominantly to hadrons. And roughly speaking, you know, for the axion portal, then as long as you're below di tau, because of course once you're above di tau, the thing wants to go to tau tau, not mu mu. You're setting limits that are at the PeV scale, right? So this is quite high. So this gives you an idea of the sensitivity. You could also do something more simple and set it the limits on, say, the mixing angle between this new field and the Higgs field. And we plotted it here as the mixing angle squared because that's what the branching fraction goes as. And the black is showing that the data, roughly speaking, we're excluding about the mixing angle squared of about 10 to the minus 7. Inflaton models tend to be like, basically, we almost exclude the basic inflaton models below a GeV. We almost completely got it. They're basically like, it has to be greater than about right here and up. And so we basically exclude almost the entire thing. And this just shows what we roughly predict we can exclude in runs 2 and 3 with more stats. So it goes down a bit better there. So that gives you an idea of the reach there. Now, I mentioned earlier that we're going to a triggerless readout system in run 3. So now our trigger scheme will be, you know, basically 30 or 40 megahertz. I can explain the difference there if you're interested, but you probably don't care. So whatever. There's something like 40 megahertz of crossing. And then we're just going to run the full reconstruction. So the idea is that, you know, hardware is annoying. There's lots of physics you could do and that you can't find a signature for. So why don't you just reconstruct the data, then calibrate it, and then just look at the final data all in real time and then do whatever you want. And so for our main physics program, this is obviously very good if you're doing precision measurements. But also if you want to start doing things with low mass beyond the standard model stuff, you can imagine where there's just simply no signature, striking signature, in the, you know, until you have the full reconstructed event.
Yeah, can I ask you something? So you say that the depth of the path is very close to the collision points, like 5 millimeters from the collision.
It's 8 millimeters now, and it will be 5. Yeah.
So I have a question for you. Have you guys thought at all about doing searches of particles, maybe that are not that low mass, but basically will decay to invisible energy sub-centimeter distances?
Yeah, we have like one paper in run 1 which looks for like basically emerging jets. We also have one paper in run 1.
What do you mean emerging jets? This would be...
So basically that all the tracks in the jet look like they're all displaced and they don't have hits in the first, tracking system.
I was thinking of something else. I was thinking of something that is produced. Let's say you produced, but actually this is something that can appear like let's say you have a light Higgsino, and it's just a Higgsino, so the charge and the neutral state are separated by a tiny, tiny amount, actually it's 315 MeV. So you produce, let's say, the two charged Higgsinos, the decay to a pion and the neutral Higgsino, and that happens if you calculate what the distance, the C tau of this is sub-centimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you have a very soft pion and missing energy. And there is a charge track. If you had continuous coverage, there would be a charge track that's, let's say, centimeter big. So have you guys considered doing searches like this?
I don't think we've considered that specific one. The difficulty is always going to be getting away from charm and beauty. So you need that the signature doesn't look like charm, which you can do if the flight distance is large enough, right? Because charm decays pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But of course, you get a lot of charm decays where the only charged particle is there's one charged pion and everything else is neutral. So there's a lot of, and charm is produced in like every collision. Yeah. So that, this is always the, that if your flight distance is small enough where charm is a background, then you have to find a way to kill that.
You could tell it apart based on the track being different.
The what?
So what Mina is talking about is track one.
Oh, you want to look for a? Oh, sorry. You want charge one.
I mean, so the charge in Tina has a charge of one, whereas so it's a disappearing track of charge one.
Oh, so you want to have basically a track that itself goes away.
Yeah.
Just to give you an idea, the bound, if you look at Atlas and CMS, the bound, they have no bound production of this particle.
Yeah,
so it's just the left bound of 100 J.
Yeah, in principle, we could do this. The other search we did, which is similar for heavy stuff, was if it's stable enough to get to our ring imaging system,
then it would leave a
ring. And so in principle, you could look for rings that are inconsistent with any known mass of a stable particle. So we did that and didn't.
How far is it?
The first one's about a meter, and the second one is really far. So basically, if you can get it to live a meter and go into the ring imaging, now it's interesting because you would have this, some ring there. We've talked a little bit about this with Jesse, but if you have new ideas, we've been throwing around ideas with things like with the tracking, because once you have the tracking up front, in principle, you can also look for things where the charge doesn't make sense. So you're tracking something that looks like it has charge two, or whatever, because that's something you can tell in the silicon. There's too much charge there and things like this.
I'm thinking about something that looks like this that's just charged one minus one produced in pairs, and then you have tracks that's roughly a centimeter big,
mm-hmm.
maybe a bit more, and then goes to a very soft pion, and then a missing energy. Of course, you're missing energy, I guess your construction should be.
No, we don't do missing energy.
Yeah.
Because we don't cover anywhere near 4 pi, so like we should always be missing energy, basically.
Yeah.
But there are ways to do similar things. So we could talk about it afterward.
Yeah,
if you, and, I mean, I assume that there's probably lots of things we can do that we're not doing.
So why couldn't you do triggered readout now? What's the
The front end electronics? So you basically have a gigabytes per second limit of how much information you can get off the detector. And at the moment, it's, the only way we could do it is if we just cranked the luminosity down really far. So it's, when the detector was designed, going out at 1 megahertz was thought to be insane already, right? So it's just like, and then as soon as you make it work, it's like, okay, well, let's just go to 40, right? Which then, when you first say that, people think it's insane. You can't do that. But so we just keep pushing it. I mean, we've already done a lot of what in our upgraded technical design report. I mean, all this real-time calibration was supposed to be run 3, but then we were working on it, and we just figured, we could do it run 2. Let's just go for it. And I mean, software is great, right? Because you can also just do whatever you want. I mean, anytime there's a technical stop, which happens every few weeks, we can change the entire trigger. It's just very easy. You just put an image on the thing and let it propagate. It takes a few hours, so you can change everything you're doing. The flexibility is going to be really good. So in principle, you could do a lot of stuff. So then the one idea that Jesse Taylor and I had sort of right away was the idea of looking for dark photons in the really low mass region where it has to go to E plus E minus. Now this is a huge pain, right? Because electrons are a pain because they bremsstrahlung. And they're also a pain because photons convert into E plus E minus in the trackers. And so at the hardware level, you have no hope here because there's always at least a photon that converts into E plus E minus in like every collision and things. So there's nothing special about that. But we had the idea of tackling this once you have the trigger list readout using charm decay. So a D star, this is a vector charm meson, and it radiatively decays into D0, which is the ground state charm meson, and a photon. This is something like a 30 or 40% branching fraction for this particular meson. And so if you go into run three, the rate at the standard model process here within our acceptance with some reasonable PT cuts on things is actually about a megahertz. Okay, so you have this really nice, well-known process that's happening at a very high rate. And okay, you can pretty easily calculate then how many dark photons you expect because you have the photon and it has some kinetic mixing and you get a dark photon. And so you go do this calculation and essentially the ratio of the dark photon to the photon is whatever this mixing between the photon and dark photon is times some phase space factor. So it's exactly what you'd expect it to be. So it's very, very simple. And while soft electrons are in a lot of ways annoying, it turns out if you have a ring imaging system, you cannot misidentify like a 5 or whatever GeV electron because it's the only particle that emits Cherenkov radiation. Okay, so there's in the first ring imaging system. So any nice ring there is actually just an electron. So there's no way you screw up that it's an electron. The bad thing is that you Bremsstrahlung. So for example, here we generated some signals with some toy Monte Carlo at 10 MeV, 20, 50, and 100. And what you would get just from the native resolution, just looking for the E plus E minus, is in these sort of dotted lines. So here's if you had a 100 MeV particle. And this tail here is just because you get Bremsstrahlung radiation. The electrons emit a photon, and it really degrades the resolution. But you actually know the mass of the D star. And if you measure the D0 particle well, and you know the mass of this guy, then in fact, you can actually correct for the Bremsstrahlung effect because you know what the total invariant mass of the D0 and the EE should have been. So you can actually correct this. And so here we show the corrected, once you do the correcting, and I won't go into the details about what this F and P type is how you actually reconstruct the D0. So the F type does slightly better, whatever. You can see that you basically still have some tail, but overall you have most of your events are sitting in a core that has a resolution of a few MeV. Okay, so you can basically correct this. The other thing that's nice is that you can look at consistency of this D0 EE mass with the D star to begin with, and essentially you can kill combinatorial type backgrounds. Your background is essentially going to be just there's going to be a standard model process where this is an off-shell photon, and then there's going to be a standard model process where the photon from this process converts to E plus E minus, and those are your only relevant backgrounds that you have to deal with.
What's the final state that you're using to tag D0?
We use a bunch of them. Yeah, so for like, F-type for us meant fully reconstructed. So essentially we just considered D0 goes to K pi and D0 goes to K 3 pi where everything's charged. And then the P-type is what we called pseudo-fully. We've actually done this in a bunch of papers. So if you're only missing one neutral particle, you don't have to actually go find it as long as you know which one you're missing because you know the D0 mass. And the direction of flight of the D0 you can get from the primary vertex and secondary vertex. And so you can actually solve for the momentum. And if you're interested, I can go through the details. But it's sort of a well-known thing to do. But you get slightly worse resolution doing that. Okay, so we looked at this in detail, and we tried to do our best to be conservative with all our estimates for run three. And we considered the idea of just not using displacement information, so just looking on top of the standard model background. So here you're just driven by what's your mass resolution and how much luminosity do you have. And this is the mass of your dark photon, and this is this epsilon squared, this mixing, which is the ratio of, say, the coupling of the dark photon alpha prime to alpha. So if alpha prime is 1 over 137, you'd have 1 on this axis. The existing limits from all the previous experiments are shown as these gray regions. So what you have is from searches for rare meson decays or at B factories, you have coming down from epsilon equals 1 to about 10 to the minus 6 is ruled out. And then from beam dump experiments, when the coupling is very weak, the dark photon gets a long lifetime. And so beam dump experiments start to rule out from about 10 to the minus 10 on down. But there's this gap here, which is actually in the interesting region, which I won't go into why it's interesting, but it is. So essentially, just on pure luminosity means in run three, we can actually cover about an order of magnitude of the space. But then also using our vertex locator and just the fact that we have this amazing displacement resolution, we can cover this solid region here. So if you combine those, you actually get pretty much everything below 100 MeV. Yeah. Well, yeah, so we don't know what its mass is, so we have to. That's why we have the limits as a function of its mass. So what we have to do in the data is just search. You know, we scan in the E plus E minus for, if it doesn't have a lifetime, then it's simply, you know, there's a continuum background from off-shell photon, and then there might be a resonant peak that shows up. And so that would be how you see it.
Dark matter has to be stable.
No, so typically here, the dark photon would be the force-carrying particle in the dark sector. So this would be just like our photon. It would be, you know, mediating some interaction between dark matter particles. So the dark matter particles are stable, and this is just how they interact with each other. So typically what people want for its mass then, so Sean's the expert on this, so you can ask him, but he's sitting right next to you. But basically, if you look at things like cores and things in galaxies, people tend to try and estimate like what's the size of the interaction between dark matter. And then if you hand wave this, you typically get things like 10 MeV to 10 GeV or something.
It could be it's stable myself.
If it's stable, yeah.
It's not thermally produced.
So if it's stable, we won't see it. In this particular, in our search, we won't see it here if it's stable, because we're looking for the decay into E plus E minus. Yeah. There are people that try to do searches for the invisible dark photon, where it's either stable or it decays into some other particle that you can't detect, right? So that's another option. It might just decay into some stable dark matter particle that doesn't interact with your detector either. But that's not something that's obvious how you would do that at the LHC. So typically there you want to look for missing energy, so you have some fixed target experiment where you have the beam and everything's well measured in the initial state, and then you try to measure things in the final state and look for some evidence for an invisible particle statistically. But yeah, well, I don't have any good ideas of how to do that at the LHC at the moment. That would be hard. Anyway, so yeah, you can also see a bunch of lines from proposed experiments, some of which will run and some of which I think maybe won't run. But anyway, we seem to do better than all of them. And I'll just mention that Jesse and I and our collaborators at MIT, we're actually now working on the more general strategy of looking for direct production of the A prime. So just proton, proton, how many A primes do you make? Which is a big number, followed by going to dimuon, where we don't need all these tricks because the dimuon mass resolution is excellent and photons don't convert into dimuons and things like this. So dimuon is just easier experimentally. So just to maybe encourage you to think about LHCb for new physics ideas, so why do we do better than some of these other experiments, or predict that we're going to do better? One is that it's parasitic running. So the detector itself has lots of unique capabilities, and it runs basically all the time, right? So when you design a purpose-built experiment, you're always competing for beam time, and you might run for a month or something, or a couple months, and that's a big deal if you're getting beam time at a lab. Whereas we can just run all the time, you know, it's going to run anyway, so if you can come up with an idea, it's there. So it's basically, the luminosity ends up being just big because it's free. If there's some new particle, it's almost certainly going to be made at a large rate in 250 megahertz, which is if you include the pileup. That's how many proton-proton collisions we're going to have in run 3 per second, so 250 million at 14 TeV. So basically, you should make everything. The question is really just how do you find it? LHCb itself is quite unique. So our ability to resolve vertices better than anyone else, the fact that we have ring imaging Cherenkov detectors, and the triggerless readout system. So the fact that you're going to be able to go straight into software and not have to basically sacrifice the vast majority of your luminosity towards just the event was recorded for some other reason and you happen to be looking at it. Compared to fixed target experiments, we have an advantage in that we can look at very small opening angles because when you make things, dark photon or otherwise, in proton-proton, they're generally produced with some PT, and so they just fly into the detector. Whereas if you do them in fixed target, you tend to make them almost along the beam line, and you're always competing with the fact that you need a hole for the beam to go through. And so we can look at opening angles of a few milliradians as opposed to about 30 milliradians, which is about as good as the fixed target experiments can do at the moment. So this gives you access, actually, it's kind of weird. It gives you access to smaller masses, even though you're at the LHC. It's kind of a weird thing. Lorentz boosts are bigger, obviously, at the LHC, so for the same lifetime, you get a larger flight distance. So even if you have only equivalent vertex performance, the boost factor actually buys you something. And of course, you have access in principle to all masses as opposed to fixed targets, which have access to like only up to some whatever the cutoff is for what the energy they're running at. OK, how much time do I have? I have no idea. 5 minutes. OK, I'll do this very quick. So I just wanted to conclude with saying we don't just spend all our time looking for new physics and not finding it or whatever. We also do a lot of some standard model stuff, and I think some of it's very interesting. So to give you an idea, like a big part of our program for standard model physics, which then feeds down into the other physics programs at CMS and Atlas, is in PDFs. So this is a plot of the momentum fraction of a parton versus the momentum transfer squared, q squared. And it's a cartoon that's showing, roughly speaking, what regions are covered by different experiments. So fixed target experiments can cover large x but small q squared. Hera sits in here. The Tevatron was here. CMS and Atlas are in this region. But LHCb, because it's forward, can probe simultaneously large x and very small x. So we probe things like x down to 10 to the minus 6, which is basically terra incognita. No one's ever looked at that. But we can also probe large x. And so these two things are actually quite interesting. And so potential probes, most of which we've already measured, when we just measure charm production, it turns out that just in general, the average x of the softer parton here is 10 to the minus 5. And so this is basically already probing areas where we just didn't know anything about what gluons are doing. And it turns out that this is really relevant for things like the background of atmospheric neutrinos to ice cube and things like this, where high-energy cosmic ray comes in, produces charm, charm decays, and produces neutrinos. Well, okay, so you'd like to measure that in a collider, but the problem is that effectively, for them, the highest energy ones in the collider will be going down the beamline, but we're the closest to the beamline. So we have the best measurement that constrains that. If you make top quarks, and one of the top quarks goes into LHCb, this is mostly gluon-gluon scattering, where the higher X gluon on average is 0.2. So this is like a very high X gluon, where we don't know much. And so we're making measurements to constrain that, which then are relevant if there is a 2 TeV resonance in CMS or Atlas. This directly translates. Reducing the uncertainty on top quark production directly translates into reducing the uncertainty there. So we can also look at things like W plus jet production. And if we crank up the PT threshold on the jet, it turns out we can actually probe things like the down quark to up quark ratio at x equals 0.7 or 0.8. And this is something that's really unknown. We can look at things like Z plus charm production to probe large X charm, which is actually a topic that people have debated forever. But we can actually go after this in run two directly. And if we replace the Z with a W here, we're probing the S quark, and the charge of the W tells you whether this is a strange or an anti-strange quark. And so, in fact, in run two, we're going to be able to, if there's a decent asymmetry between strange and anti-strange in the proton, we actually think we can go after that. That's something that's not currently known. But of course, if I want to do these things, I need to be able to tag charm jets. And if I want to do this, I need B jets. And so in run one, we actually used our world's best secondary vertex ability to develop an algorithm to identify beauty in charm jets. This is published here. And I'll just show the most interesting aspect, I think, is it's, of course, uses machine learning and very complicated. But one of the features is what we call the corrected mass. So this, you can imagine, you resolve the proton-proton collision, the secondary vertex. That gives you the direction of flight of the beauty or charm hadron. The charged momentum, the visible momentum, then will have some direction with respect to that direction. Whatever momentum is transverse to the direction of flight has to be part of the mass. So that the momentum that's transverse to the direction of flight, that's a boost invariant quantity, right? As I boost along, that's always going to contribute into the mass, and so we can add it back in. And if we do that, we can see here, this is real data that we enriched in charm and beauty, the black points here. And these are templates that show you what this looks like. In this particular feature, charm peaks at the charm mass. It's wider than, say, our default mass resolution, but it still peaks. And whereas beauty doesn't. Beauty just has some blob. I can tell you why if you're interested, but it's pretty easy to explain. So basically, from even just looking at this one feature of a bunch of tagged jets, I can tell you how many charm jets there are. Now, in reality, we do something complicated. We have two boosted decision trees, and so we have in data some two-dimensional plane where every tagged jet falls in here somewhere, and B jets sit in this region up here, charm jets in this region, and light jets over here. But there's very little overlap, and that's what's really unique about this, is that we can pretty cleanly separate the B jets, which are this dark bit here, from the charm jets, which are this bit here. And we've calibrated this in data and everything, and we also used it to measure, say, like the dye B jet forward central asymmetry. And because I'm running out of time, I'll just say that we basically used this already to measure top quark production in run one, W plus charm production, and all kinds of other measurements. And in run two, the statistics for us will go up by factors of 10 or 20 for these things. So we'll really start to actually constrain things.
Are there any concentrated new parts
for gluon tagging? We've talked a little bit about it. We'll see. In principle, I think we could do things like this. So the question is, what can we do better than CMS now? So one of the things we can do is, we actually looked at this roughly just for fun, was we can look at things where there was actually two charm quarks in the same jet. That's pretty easy, actually, for us. So, you know, whether that gives you a handle then on gluons and things, like, you know, it's not obvious exactly what observables translate into gaining insight into that sort of tagging versus what just shows you that, yeah, you don't actually model this well, which is something that's already well known. Right, I think, so this is basically a program where we've done all the proof of principle, now we just need the stats, and I think we'll have a lot of constraints. And so that's because I'm out of time, I was gonna just say, you know, we've observed a tetraquark candidate and a pentaquark candidate, and these get millions of citations. and so I pretty much guarantee you'll see lots more of this in the future, and hopefully it gets us a lot of funding. And so my conclusion is essentially that LHCb is a terrible name for the experiment, because while we were basically designed to be a B-physics experiment, and we are the best B-physics experiment in the world, we actually can do lots and lots and lots of physics, and so hopefully we'll keep expanding what we're doing in the future, and if you have good ideas, then I'd love to hear them. So thanks.
More questions?
Yeah.
Fourth generation of probes has been excluded to 8 seconds. The parameters are family parameters, Z parameter, P parameter. So the things that are left are weird learning logic, the effective probes, which have a bare mass. So I think if they exist, I'm throwing away 50 years of physics because the chiral mass is so. What do you expect to see after 14 TeV? After that, we have to wait 20, 30 years.
The argument for flavor physics, right, is you can probe these high mass, much higher mass scales than you probe the direct production. So if you keep improving the data and you know things, then something at 40 TeV, 50 TeV could show up as a discrepancy in these indirect measurements. Now, whether that'll happen or not, I don't know. But it really becomes a problem, right, in terms of, let's say you don't see any discrepancies with run 3 or 4. And flavor physics really is telling you that, like, either you have to then say the couplings are just really small, or there just really is nothing for another couple orders of magnitude, then you don't know what to build, right? That's the real problem, is you don't know what experiment to build. That's to me. Because then you have no idea, like, you know, what mass range do I need to cover in the next experiment? Well, whatever you're going to build next. But like, if, for example, if in flavor you see some consistent set of discrepancies, and you know that at tree level that you know is probably at most a 70 TeV particle, then at least you have a target. So okay, let's build a 100 TeV machine. We should see something. But if we see nothing, and there's no direct evidence of anything in CMS or Atlas, then I don't know, you know, can you convince someone to give you $100 billion to build a machine that goes to 100 TeV? Because you might not see anything.
Chinese.
Well, their economy's not so hot at the moment either.
Economy's not doing so well.
For the Engler distribution, the one that's the high statistical, but there could be uncertainties in terms of the standard model prediction. Is there a way forward there to?
Yeah, so, okay. Well, so at least, so one of the ideas here, so if you have enough data,
yeah,
you can do these global fits in bins of dimuon mass.
Okay.
And if what you're looking at is a 7 TeV resonance, its amplitude is effectively independent of dimuon mass, right? So you're so far away that it's just 1 over the mass squared. So what you should see eventually, if you have the precision, is you should see that the Wilson coefficient for the beyond the standard model physics is the same in all the mass bins.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, we don't have enough data. So people have done it, but effectively the error bars are big enough that it could be consistent with them being different or the same.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a nice way that if you have run 2 and 3, you now have enough data that you can say, well, okay, we can at least sort this out from the data itself. We don't need to know whether it's just that for whatever reason QCD is doing something here that we don't understand. Because if, for example, you looked at the Wilson coefficient for the beyond the standard model physics and it looks like, you know, 0 here and it gets real big by the charm and went back down, you would say, this must be some sort of like charm loop problem that doesn't, no one knows how to calculate, but it's contributing or something like that, you know, glue ball or something like this, or, you know, whatever that's not included in the calculation for the standard model. So that's a nice way of, you know, with enough data, yeah, you could do it. But before you have that much data, these guys, if this is real, you would have this sort of sorted out. Because I think these ratios where you have muons versus electrons,
yeah.
I mean, you know, there's very detailed calculations. If you hand wave it, you'd say it's probably one, and then people have done these very detailed calculations, and they see the per mil changes from one. Mm-hmm. So if you measure this and it's not one, then okay,
right.
Now you're...
Yeah, no, too much.
And then you probably would be, you know, you're still motivated to bother to do this in Bins and Q-squared eventually, but you'd probably be less... If you already knew there was new physics contributing, you'd be less suspicious. The other thing that's weird about it is that if you look at these individually, these processes where you have the electrons actually agree with the standard model prediction for the branching fraction. So the ratio is not one because the muons are smaller. Yeah. So what you need, if it's not new physics, it's actually that you've screwed up the calculation, but then you've also screwed up the measurement of the electrons, but in a way that they agree, which is of course possible. I mean, you know, but like that's what has to be. So if it's not new physics, that's what it is. Somehow the theory calculation's wrong and the measurement of electrons is wrong in a way that they agree with each other, but yet the easier measurement of the muons is then, because that's what disagrees. You can assign whatever Bayesian prior you want to, which is, whether that's true. But with more data, it'll answer itself.
I had one more question on the light new physics part. So for the stuff you did already with the prime decaying to electrons, I mean, it's obvious what mass range you get because you have to be able to decay to electrons and then you have the base space. So when you're...
You go a bit above 100 MeV, right?
Right?
Something like that.
So when you're actually directly producing these now, the stuff you're doing, how high mass do you think you can reach? I mean, it depends on a couple, but...
Right. I mean, in principle... Well, I mean, I don't know where at what point the... there's no limits on dark photon production at the moment above 10 GeV. Basically, that I've ever seen anyone bother to set. Yeah, so I've never seen these converted into a dark photon limit, so I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, you could look at Z to mu mu spectra, and in principle, there.
So the dark photon will meet with the Z, so it will change the mass of Z?
Yeah.
So there are measurements on left. So above 10 GeV, I guess the Bang left one is 10 to the minus 2 or so.
Okay, so it's pretty weak.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, with dimuon, we see z to mu mu very like lots and lots of that. So in principle, we can go up to whatever 100 GeV or something.
Okay.
But it's not so obvious, I guess, when you have if it has a short lifetime. I'm not sure exactly how you calculate the rate if the mass is like close to the z. If its mass is like 80 GeV, it must mix with the Z and the gamma.
Right.
I'm not sure how you exactly would calculate what the rate of that is.
We can talk
more
later, pretend that's...
Okay. Yeah, I just don't know how to do it to reliably do the calculation. Yeah, I'm sure it's doable. I just don't know. I just don't know what the answer is.
It's easier than PCB.
Yeah. So then I, you know, because I don't know the answer, I couldn't tell you based on like how much Drell-Yan we see at 40 GeV, how many, what sort of, where we would fall on this axis in the top of my head. I don't know the answer. But there's no reason why you can't see like, you know,
okay.
I mean, dimuons get easier. Yeah, I mean, we can measure the Z very cleanly and things, so. And hopefully, the goal is to do dimuon the whole way down to threshold, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, doing it all the way down at 210 MeV and then go the whole way up. And we're going to start doing that in run two, even without. So we'll have to deal with the fact that there's a hardware trigger that says the dimuon has to have PT above a GeV.
Mm-hmm.
But then beyond that, we're in software, so we can hopefully just go from there.
Let's thank Mike again.
Yep.